Officials in the Gaza war adding that all the regime's supporters are complicit in its crimes. More Palestinians have lost their lives as Israel carries out new airstrikes on Gaza. That's despite the regime's expected truce agreement with the Palestinian resistance movement to pause the war on the besieged strip. Regime forces struck Abu Iskandar, an area in close proximity to the Indonesia hospital in northern Gaza. Multiple strikes were also reported elsewhere, including Deir al-Bala and Nusayrat refugee camps in central Gaza, as well as Khan Yunis and Rafah in the south. Since the beginning of the Israeli onslaught on Gaza, more than 14,500 Palestinians have been killed, most of them women and children. Over 7,000 people have been reported missing. On Wednesday, the warring sides agreed to a four-day truce mediated by Qatar and Egypt, but it has not gone into effect.
The agreement will last for 4 days after it takes effect. Israel will suspend its military actions in Gaza. During the truce, the Israeli regime is committed not to abduct anyone all across the besieged territory. Palestinians will be free to move from northern to southern Gaza via Salah ad-Din Road. Also, according to the deal, air traffic will completely stop during the four-day ceasefire in the southern Gaza Strip. In the north, however, air traffic will stop daily for 6 hours from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Hamas says it will release 50 Israeli captives in exchange for the freedom of 150 Palestinian women and children held in Israeli jails. Last but not least, hundreds of trucks of humanitarian aid, including fuel and medicine, will be given access to all areas of the Gaza Strip.
The temporary ceasefire was expected to start on Thursday, but the Israeli regime says the truce that includes a prisoner swap will not start until at least Friday. The deal was clinched despite a fierce opposition from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right cabinet. However, Netanyahu backed the agreement while vowing to continue the genocidal onslaught on Gaza. Well, since the beginning of the Israeli onslaught against Palestinians on October the 7th, the regime has sought to destroy the resistance groups there. However, Palestinians' resistance turned the Gaza Strip into a quagmire for Israeli troops, forcing the regime to redefine its objectives. Here's the main objectives Israel had been pursuing in its war on Gaza.
Israeli officials repeatedly stated the destruction of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, as their main objective by targeting the group's military infrastructure. However, since day one, Hamas has been a thorn in the eye of the occupation regime as resistance fighters continued their retaliatory attacks on Israeli targets. Therefore, the regime has failed to achieve its main goals.
And this just in, breaking news that we have from Gaza, according to an Al-Shifa doctor. That's a hospital in northern Gaza. They're stating that the hospital director, Mohammed Abu Samia, has been arrested by Israeli forces. More details on that story as we get it for you. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says it has carried out several strikes against Israel's military sites in response to the regime's brutal aggression against Gaza. Hezbollah said it targeted the positions of Israeli soldiers and vehicles in Al-Rahib near Lebanon's southern border with Burkan rockets, causing casualties. The movement also targeted several Israeli posts in Bayad Belida, as well as other military targets, including a number of Israeli barracks with appropriate weapons. Meanwhile, Israeli warplanes raided a number of areas in southern Lebanon, including the village of Beit Yahoun. According to a statement by Hezbollah, the strike killed 5 members of the movement, including the son of the head of Hezbollah's parliamentary bloc, Mohammad Raad. Our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, has talked to some Lebanese citizens about a truce to halt Israel's war on the Gaza Strip. Let's take a listen how people react to the truce agreement between the Israeli regime and the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas.
The steadfastness of the resistance proved that the occupation could not complete its mission or achieve any military objective, and even on the issue of the prisoners, they were forced to negotiate. Therefore, we consider any truce that is agreed upon by the resistance would be a new achievement for the resistance and the steadfast people of Palestine, at least in this phase, which is considered a partial deal until we reach a stage of emptying Israeli jails from Palestinian prisoners.
The truce is a demand for the resistance since it realizes the most important objective of the Al-Aqsa flood operation, which is the liberation of the Palestinian prisoners in the jails of the Israeli occupation. The resistance also achieved an important gain, which is that the enemy was forced to concede. The enemy had said there would be no ceasefire before Hamas and Islamic Jihad released all the Israeli prisoners.
For what really matters, as the Western humanity fails over and over again, as the Palestinians are being massacred, Palestinian children are being shredded into pieces, as the world stands idle, as we are dehumanized over and over again, the only response to the Israeli atrocities, to what's going on in Palestine and in the south of Lebanon, is resistance. We will stand by our resistance. And the only way to get our freedom, because we are the oppressed people here, we are the oppressed people over here, and we'll stand by our resistance, we will raise our voices, we will not wait for your humanity, because your humanity failed.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says Israel has failed to achieve any of the goals it pursued in the war on Gaza.
Killing women and children is not victory. Why did the Israeli regime enter Gaza? It said it wanted to capture Gaza, but it failed. It said its goal was to eliminate Hamas, but it couldn't do that. It said it wanted to do away with the resistance, but it failed. The regime has so far had no achievement.
Raisi, speaking in an interview with 5 Arab television channels, he said the regime's atrocities have only increased awareness of people across the globe about the plight of Palestinians. Iran's president added that people of the world now hate the regime and its backers more than ever. Raisi said Operation Al-Aqsa Flood dealt a heavy military and intelligence blow to the Zionist regime. He added that the Israeli regime collapsed after October the 7th, that is when the operation was launched, but the U.S. Helped to revive it.
After October 7, it can be said that the regime really collapsed. It was the Americans who came and helped it survive. The reason why Americans and other Western officials rushed to the occupied territories was that they were seriously worried. Some of them told officials in the region that they felt the regime collapsed all of a sudden.
Raisi said the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is a war criminal and intends to go ahead with the aggression against Gaza. Iran's president stressed that all countries that support Israel are complicit in its crimes against Palestinian people. He also called on all Muslim states to sever their relations with the occupying entity. Well, we do have more breaking news now coming out of Gaza. The Palestinian Health Ministry has stated that the Israeli regime has ordered the Indonesian hospital to be evacuated within 4 hours. Just earlier, we had news of the director of the Al-Shifa hospital being arrested by Israelis. We are going to keep you posted on all the latest developments with regards to the Israeli war on Gaza. Joining us now from Doha is director of the Center for Muslim Affairs, Mr. Jahangir Mohammed, to offer us more insight on this ongoing massacre taking place against Palestinians in Gaza. Mr. Mohammed, let's start off with your thoughts on the announced truce with the Palestinian resistance groups based in Gaza. Many are pointing that the Israelis have failed to achieve any of their objectives, and that's why they're in this position right now.
Well, I think the first thing to point out is that the massacres have been ongoing yesterday, and as of yet, there's been no pause in the massacring and the fighting. So, from the Israel's own objectives, which they said was to defeat Hamas, and that they wouldn't negotiate with them, and that they would release all the hostages through their own military, then they failed in that. Clearly, 47 days later, they failed to dislodge or defeat Hamas in Gaza. They failed in that respect, and they've also had a massive failure in terms of their global propaganda machine, their war machine globally, which until recently has been, if you like, portrayed as a moral army, an invincible army, and the world is seeing what Israel's army is in reality. Their achievements to date are massacring 14,000 people, destroying schools, destroying mosques, destroying houses, and destroying hospitals and healthcare systems. So it seems like they're waging war on people and buildings, and trying to destroy all the means of livelihood for the people of Gaza, so that they would flee into Egypt. And of course, there are operations going in the West Bank, where, you know, to over 206 people had died until recently, and people are being arrested. They're hoping people will flee to Jordan there. So even in this objective of displacing the Palestinian people, despite all the suffering, have not fled. They've not gone to Egypt, and this has shocked them, the resilience of the Palestinian people to stay in their homeland, not be annexed, not be ethnically cleansed, is a great shock to the Israeli military. So they haven't really achieved any success. And of course, we don't know the numbers that of Israeli soldiers and vehicles that have been destroyed, but the sort of anecdotal evidence that's coming out seems to show that they've incurred losses.
We've got our correspondent Ashraf Shannon, who's joining us from Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. Ashraf, it's great to have you with us. A number of developments within the hour regarding, first of all, the ceasefire agreement being delayed. More Israeli raids have continued across the Gaza Strip. And just recently we had news of the director of the Al-Shifa hospital being arrested by the Israelis. And the Indonesian hospital has been given a warning to evacuate within 4 hours. Help us better understand what's happening right now.
Well, Badia, regarding the humanitarian pause, as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has termed it, it's still hanging there. Nothing concrete. The Hamas was saying yesterday, 10 a.m. today. That didn't happen. I mean, it's not 10 a.m. yet, but the Israeli regime has denied agreeing for 10 a.m. They kept saying that it's not going to happen before Friday. While as of last night, around 6 p.m., Israeli fighter jets and Israeli tanks carried hundreds of air raids and artillery attacks, as well as Israeli gunboats shelling the coastline of Nusayrat, Gaza, Khan Yunis, and Rafah throughout the night until the early hours of the morning. And the attacks, the artillery attacks, mainly concentrated or targeted areas east of the southern Gaza Strip towns of Rafah and Khan Yunis, as well as Johr al-Dik, that's just adjacent to the Gaza Wadi or Gaza Valley in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. That's the last village near the Gaza Valley. On average right now, between 200 to 300 people are being killed every night. Yesterday, 280 people have been killed. Until the early hours of this morning, at least 80 in Khan Yunis. We're not sure about the numbers in Gaza, but there are dozens of deaths in the northern parts of the Gaza Strip. Now, regarding Shifa Hospital, early reports suggest that Dr. Mohammed Abu Salmiya, director of Shifa Hospital, was arrested. But we have to understand that all the injured, the patients, and the medical staff inside Shifa hospitals are already being held hostage by the Israeli regime. They're not necessarily arrested by the Israelis. They are hostages inside Shifa hospital. While the Indonesian hospital is completely vacant right now, at least as far as the injured are concerned, because last night hundreds of injured and injured and the patients were driven by buses on Saladin Road. They went into Israeli checkpoint, and some of the ambulance drivers and hospital drivers were detained by the Israeli regime forces on Saladin Road near the Nisarim checkpoint. Now, those who the patients and the injured who brought out of Indonesian hospital, most of them came here to Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis, as well as the Gaza European Hospital in Khan Yunis, while a few dozen of them were taken to the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir el-Balah. It's worth mentioning that although they were brought here, that doesn't mean they're going to receive medical care, because there is no medical care here. Basically, it's first aid. This all what the doctors and the medics can do here, because there are no medicines in Khan Yunis hospitals, including Nasser Hospital, no anesthesia, nothing. You can hardly find gauze to wrap the limbs of wounded people.
Thank you, Ashraf. Thanks a lot, Sir John Gil Muhammad, Director of the Center for Muslim Affairs, joining us from Doha. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Hidden Files.
Being punished for the original sin, and that is beating white supremacy colonialism. That is how some experts describe what has happened and continues to happen to a small but significant nation in the Caribbean, Haiti. Slavery in Haiti began after the arrival of Christopher Columbus on the island in 1492 with European colonists that followed from Portugal, Spain, and France. In the late 18th century and early 19th century, in Saint-Domingue, as Haiti was once called, the French had enslaved 500,000 Africans there. Well, the slaves would harvest coffee, sugarcane, and work the cotton fields and serve the Europeans in whatever ways the colonialists deemed necessary. This island became France's most lucrative possession. Ultimately, the slaves who were treated terribly started revolting against the French. Now, this movement ultimately led to their victory over the imperialist colonialists, and Haiti became the only country in the world where former slaves succeeded in overthrowing their enslavers and establishing their own country. These Africans were able to beat one of the best militaries at the time that was led by Napoleon. He sent 50,000 French troops to the island, but ultimately France and their European and American supporters lost This is the original sin that Africans were successful in beating European colonizers. And some analysts say the American European Front has never forgiven Haiti for winning and for being black. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Haiti set an example when it declared its independence in 1804. It became the first country in the world to permanently outlaw slavery and ban imperial rule during a time when slavery was the norm in many countries. Haiti was the symbol of freedom. Haiti broke the common rule of the day that liberty and equality were for white men only. Haiti said that no human beings should ever be enslaved. It sounds very enlightening, but that is not how the French, the Americans, and others saw it. Leaders wanted to do whatever they could in order for Haiti not to succeed. And those who revolted in Haiti wanted to do whatever they could in order for the revolution to succeed.
U.S. President Thomas Jefferson was worried that the revolution in Haiti could ignite a slave revolt in the United States, and he would do his best not to help Haiti's southern slaveholders, who were very fearful that this could spread and encourage U.S. politicians to overthrow the new country. Napoleon Bonaparte, French military leader at the time, wrote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the blacks in Saint-Domingue is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever the forward march of blacks in the world." After Haiti had routed the French and its allies, the first leader of Haiti, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, said about the victory, "These impeccable enemies of the rights of man have been punished for their crimes. Yes, we have paid these true cannibals back, crime for crime, war for war, outrage for outrage. I have saved my country. I have avenged America."
Well, when listening to this story of Haiti, it sounds like a part of history that took place a long time ago in the past. But the reality is that as we bring you this program today, the Haitian people are on the streets and have been for months. The people are demanding an end to foreign intervention and the theft of their wealth. They want the United Nations not to interfere, and they want these Western and so-called international entities to stop impoverishing Haiti and to stop trying to enslave this nation once again. Well, to help me look at this further, I'd like to turn to our guest, Dr. Jemima Pierre.
Dr. Jemima Pierre is a professor of African American Studies and Anthropology. Currently, she teaches at the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA. She is the coordinator of the Haiti Americas team, Black Alliance for Peace, and editor and contributor for the Black Agenda Report.
Well, Dr. Pierre, thanks so much for being with us here at Hidden Files. You know, whenever we hear anything about Haiti, it is always negative and the country's demonized. In your perspective, why is that the case?
Well, you know, there's a great quote by the African-American abolitionist, Frederick Douglass, who says that Haiti has never been forgiven for winning the revolution against slavery and colonialism. And so we have to start there. We have to start thinking about its 200 and some years of constant demonization, constant move to suppress Haitian self-determination. And so from the very beginning, so people should know that, for example, you know, Haiti became independent in 1804. The U.S. and the West did not really recognize Haitian independence until 1865. And so it's been hard going ever since then, trying to maintain sovereignty and independence. And the West, I think, really has this really deep hatred for that history because it did upend the entire system of slavery and colonization in the New World.
Well, I mean, what would you say to some people that, you know, that happened over 200 years ago? Why would they still try to punish Haiti today?
Well, it is interesting, right, to say that for such a country that, for a country that is so small, and for a country that seems insignificant, the U.S. really spends a lot of time and money trying to control it. And so we have to think about, for example, the fact that even after independence, what you had was constant affronts by the French, by the British, but by the U.S. So the U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934, which is one of the longest occupations in the region. very brutal. In fact, the U.S. Practiced its first aerial bombing campaigns in Haiti during that occupation. The U.S. has the fourth largest embassy in Haiti. And you have to, so you're saying, well, if Haiti's so inconsequential, why does it have the fourth largest embassy? Why in 2003 did France, U.S., and Canada meet in Ottawa? It's, if you, your listeners can look up the Ottawa Initiative, met in Ottawa, basically coming up with a plan to remove the democratically elected president of Haiti, which plan succeeded in February 2004, the year of the 200th anniversary of the Haitian independence. And so there's a lot of history that demonstrates that there's this really deep deep set of feelings among the Europeans for Haiti, and the way that Haiti is demonized and talked about in the news, the way that things are sensationalized. And so, you know, we in the U.S., where I am currently living, we have mass shootings every day. You know, the schools are in lockdown. This is a very violent country, but it doesn't get represented in the same way that Haiti does if we have a set of protests, set of protesters. So there's a built-up history of representations of Haiti that allow the world to actually believe that Black people, these Black people are savages that cannot run themselves. And, you know, the one quote that I wanted to show is, you know, Napoleon, whose army, which at the time was the most powerful army in the day, was defeated by the Haitians. And he wrote, and I have this quote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the Blacks in Saint-Domingue," which is what Haiti was called, "is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever forward the march of the Blacks of the world, in the world." And so if you start with that quote, what does that tell you about the feelings towards Haiti? And I think ever, you know, so if you see that, and then you see all the WikiLeaks files which were released, and you see the machinations behind U.S. policy in Haiti, then everything comes clear to us. In the Security Council meetings, everyone was saying, we need an intervention because there's gang violence. And so then you had the representatives from Albania, of all places, which is like at the edge of Europe and going through its own problems. It's going to have its own security, energy crisis in a couple of months. And then you have Ireland, which barely independent, and you have Kenya. And all these people are calling for intervention because they're saying we need to deal with gang violence. What's interesting is that what doesn't come up, especially for the Latin American countries, is that Haiti is under occupation, right? And that's what I want the world to know. In 2004, when the U.S.-led coup d'etat that removed the president, put him on a plane, the U.S. Marines landed in his house, put him on a plane and flew him to Africa into exile, of all places. And then the U.S. sent the military. U.S., Canada, and France had military folks already on the ground within hours of this removal. And then they were able to get the UN to cover up this by sending in a Chapter 7 deployment of UN peacekeeping. And what you have then is you have this brutal force that was there, you know, with hundreds of thousands of soldiers, a whole apparatus. The way they were able to hide this occupation, because they were able to get a multiracial, multinational force, UN forces, to say that they're stabilizing Haiti. Haiti was not at war, so a Chapter 7 deployment means that they could use force. And the UN, which we call the occupation forces, killed thousands of people. They brought cholera into the country that killed 30,000 people because they dumped feces, you know, fecal matter in Haiti, the main water source in central Haiti. It sickened a million people, killed more than 30,000 people. The UN, took them 6 years to at least acknowledge that it was their fault. And so you have that, but under this occupation, you had the construction of what they call the core group. And this core group was founded in 2004, right when the UN Security Council resolution said that the force was coming. And the core group membership has fluctuated, but it has members from Brazil, Canada, France, Germany, Spain, the U.S., the European Union, the Organization of American States, and they basically coordinate the various branches of the United Nations occupation of Haiti. The core group still runs Haiti.
Wow, it's really something unbelievable. I mean, if we look back at 2003 that you just talked about, with the election of the Haitian president, President Aristide, and he demanded France, after he was elected, to repay Haiti $21 billion in reparations. Now, he was removed in a Western-backed coup the next year, as you had just talked about. Do you think that there is a direct correlation between the Haitian president demanding reparation and him basically being overthrown?
Oh, definitely. You know, he said that, and I think it really riled up the French, the Canadians, and the Americans, and the French in particular. And the French have a really terrible colonial role. I mean, look what they did in Libya and Algeria and all over West Africa till this day, right? They're stealing all their resources and so on. But that was really, you know, he made that speech the year before in 2003. And by the end of 2003, you have France, Canada, and the U.S. meeting in Ottawa coming up with a plan. And one of the first things they did were when they removed him, and I actually have an article that is called The Archive of Occupation, which lays out minute day by day how this coup d'etat happened from 2000, you know, from all of early 2004. And what you see is as soon as they find this guy that they bring in, and they make him, you know, interim prime minister. So they remove Aristide, they bring him. And the first thing he does was remove the petition, the request for the reparations, right? So that was one of the first acts. And so that tells me there's definitely a direct connection. And I think, you know, ever since then, you know, people have picked up on that. So, for example, the New York Times had a whole story on reparations. But what's not included in that story is the fact that Haiti's under current occupation now. And people want to forget that there's an occupation going, that there's no sovereignty in the country. But I do think it's very much linked to the request for this payment back. That you have this coup d'etat. I mean, to be fair, not to be fair, but Aristide was already, that was the second coup against Aristide. The CIA was behind a coup of Aristide in 1991, 9 months after he was elected by landslide, after we had 30 years of a U.S.-supported dictatorship. And so they've been after him, but this particular time, I think this played a big role in having him removed.
Well, stay with us, Dr. Pierre. You have a lot of information. I'll be back right after this with you.
A country with 10 million people, which shares the island with the Dominican Republic. Haiti is a country which has never been forgiven by Western imperialists for its revolution in 1803, where slaves beat them all and declared its independence. It took France until 1825 to recognize Haiti's independence, and this came only after Paris sent 12 warships and threatened Haiti to repay France for its lost revenue and property, meaning the slaves and their labor. Up until that time, no country would trade with Haiti. The French demanded the astronomical amount of 150 million gold francs. It took Haiti until 1947 to pay this crippling debt. This prevented Haiti from having funds to invest in its own country. Because of financial pressure to pay France, Haiti got a loan from the United States. In 1914, the U.S. sent soldiers to collect what they called the debt, invaded Haiti, and went directly to Haiti's national bank and walked out with $500,000 in gold, packed in wooden boxes. The gold was in the vault of a Wall Street bank within days. The U.S. then occupied Haiti for 19 years and left in name in 1934. Since that time, there has been coups, assassinations, and interference by Western governments, as well as international organizations. In 2003, the president of Haiti at the time, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, demanded that France repay Haiti for the gold francs that Paris had extorted from the country. He said that amount would now come to $21 billion. The following year, Aristide was overthrown in a coup and flown to the Central African Republic by the Americans. After the coup, the United Nations sent in troops who would remain there for 13 years, leaving a legacy of death via cholera and insecurity. 2021, President Jovenel Moïse is assassinated. 2022, currently Haiti is not being run by an elected president, but a group picked by the international community, who many would say prioritize the needs of Western countries and corporations, not the Haitian people. Currently, Haitians are on the street, and the IMF is trying to force the government to take away gasoline subsidies that would pressure the people even more.
Well, let's get back to our guest, Dr. Pierre, now. Dr. Pierre, give me a little short history of the damage you feel that's been done to Haiti by colonialism and the colonialists.
To win this independence, Haiti had to fight against the French, the Spanish, the British, the Americans. It's like they were all helping each other. And so if you ever visit Citadel in Haiti, where, you know, it's built at the top, you can see all the cannons that they had that acquired from the various European forces that were fighting them. And so that tells you that from the very beginning. But the other part is, it is, you know, the French, of course, you know, it's the gold franc that it took, which really impoverished the country, because then in order, and the leader at the time felt that he needed to do that in order to get recognition, right? This was a country that had to fight a scorched earth war against this superpower, and they were enslaved Africans with no weapons, right? And they were able to win. And so by the end of this, there's nothing left, you know, on the ground, and they have to start from scratch. But no one would no other nation would recognize them, right, for a long time. And so this president thought that maybe, you know, if they go ahead and pay France, that they would get the recognition so that you can have trade and so on and so forth. But then in paying that, it just meant that you're impoverishing the country, because, you know, it got so bad, and then they had to get a loan from the U.S. to pay off the French. And so they didn't finish paying that till very recently, right? So you can see what this means in terms of paying a debt for your own freedom, right? To paying the European, paying your former enslavers money because you dare be free. The U.S. is very... The U.S. is very much implicated in this. And I do think the Europeans work together. And so I call it, like, you know, pan-European, like, white supremacy, because they do work together. But the U.S., you know, the first thing with the French is the image of Haiti that emerges out of this period, right? So you have a brutal uprising, but they're representing it in the media, in the Western media in the 1800s, as these savages are killing white landowners, raping white women. And so if you look at the images from the early 1800s, that's what you see of Haiti, that these are like violent savages that can't stay that can't really rule themselves. And that image has really followed us over the years. So even if it was like, you know, if there was a shooting and two people got killed, it becomes huge, as opposed to the mass shootings we have in the U.S. every day, right? It doesn't make the news. And part of that is already baked into the worldview, including other countries outside of Europe, because that's the images that they're fed.
What needs to happen, in your opinion, to turn the situation around in Haiti?
It is complex. And I do talk about this, that people think, oh, Haiti is so difficult, so complex, and we don't know what to do. It's actually not that complex. What Haitians want is the UN to get out of their country. The UN is not, you know, the UN is not a democratic institution. It has five core members that make all the decisions, and the five core members are mostly from the West. You know, they finally opened it up to China and Russia, but the UN is not a democratic institution, and we are under occupation. So the Haitian people want the U.S., the U.N. to get out. They want the U.S. to remove, take down this puppet prime minister that they put in place that they don't want, because it's under this puppet prime minister that's allowing all of these things to happen. And I have to say, there's illegal mining going on in Haiti. These puppet governments have basically signed over all of Haiti's mineral resources, and the country's rich with mineral resources. They're oil companies drilling right on the outskirts of the island. And so we have to think about the fact that if Haiti is so poor, why is it that every day there are like four flights from Miami, Florida to Haiti filled with white businessmen going to Haiti to make money, right? So there's that. And so what Haitians want is they want this so-called, this prime minister that's implicated, by the way, in the assassination of the president, right? And the U.S. knows that, the U.S. has all the evidence. They want the prime minister to come down. They want the UN to leave Haiti. And they want the space for Haitian, they always say this, Haitian solutions. And, you know, before Jovenel Moïse was the president that was assassinated, before he was assassinated in July, there are a bunch of groups that came together in February 2021. And, you know, it was like a coalition for, you know, coming up with a Haitian solution. And there are several groups. One's called the Montana Group that basically laid out a plan, a two-year plan for the transitional government, elections, and so on. Well, the U.S. refused to take heed. And not only did they refuse to take heed, they managed to actually, you know, incorporate some of these individuals, right? Managed to get them so that they could basically follow through and then try to gain favor with the U.S. And so then that basically just took out all the active radical elements from the group, and basically the group just was destroyed. And so now the U.S. is talking about a Haitian solution, but it has handpicked those who are supposed to come up with a Haitian solution. So what we need is to be left alone. These people need to leave us alone. They need to leave the country, leave us alone, and we will figure it out. And we're not even being allowed to do that. They won't leave. You know, it's just, they won't leave the country. They won't stop, you know, intervening. And until they do, it's going to be a mess. And I think at this point, Haitians have had it. And I think they're willing to continue protesting. And I have to also say, these current protests have been going on for 6 weeks, but you would never know that, right? Because you would never know that they've been protesting, asking the UN to leave.
Wow, really interesting. Dr. Pierre, do you have any final comments?
Well, I just want to say I hope people will take the time and understand the situation is not an exceptional situation in the sense that Haiti is so different from the rest of us, the rest of the world. We're suffering from Western imperialism. And so if we understand Haiti and Haitian people as real human beings, not just, you know, these people who won a revolution 200 years ago, real human beings with real needs and need to have access to their own sovereignty and their self-determination. I hope the rest of the world will join us in that fight against the Western imperialism that is really holding, you know, that is keeping us under their boot.
All right, and we hope the same thing. Thanks so much for being with us here on the program, Dr. Pierre. The story of Haiti is one of a country with so much potential, so many resources, but one which has been sabotaged. Many of its members of its upper class have worked in cahoots with Western governments to steal all they can and to create chaos on the island. The real story is the wealth that has been stolen that needs to be returned. This is another story of colonialists and imperialists being held responsible and made to repay what they've stolen, though they can never really repay it. It is estimated that currently France should repay at least $120 billion for the money that it extorted from Haiti. And then the United States should be held responsible for its theft and causing instability in Haiti. There are groups that are taking these demands for reparations to the international community, but will it make a difference? What we know is that the Haitian people are revolutionary and resilient, and we hope that while they are on the streets demanding justice, that this will ultimately lead to their real independence and empowerment. Well, like all of our other files we've mentioned, we will continue to follow up on Haiti. The affluent nation, which has been impoverished and demonized, with the hope that the Haitian people will ultimately get what they deserve. Until next time, I'm Marzia Hashemi for Hidden Files.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Brothers, sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to the program Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. One of the keys of life we're discussing is taking care of your husband, and the husband taking care of his wife. So one of the duties of the wife that she needs to do towards her husband is that she needs to take care of him. And this is sometimes we find a lot of women and a lot of sisters, sadly, they lack in this department, the department of responsibility. See, marriage itself, it is, as I always say, it is a partnership, not an ownership. The wife does not own the husband, nor the husband does he own the wife. It's partnership, it's 50-50. The male has to go outside, he has to work hard, he has to do whatever he needs to be done to provide for his wife and for the family. The wife, in return, she works as hard as she can in her own house, is trying to provide for the husband and for the house, right? So when you combine these two together, you have a perfect system that works flawlessly, where each is putting his 50%, and then you have a whole 100% perfect family. When one of them starts to lack, when the male or the husband decides to stay at home and do nothing, then the house will fall apart. Or when the husband is working and the woman decides to do nothing, then the relationship will fall apart. And this is usually where relationship kind of breaks, because no one, or at least one of the two partners, decides to neglect their duties towards their partners or their spouses. So the wife, we spoke about the husband before, now with the wife. One of the things that the wife needs to do in terms of her husband, she needs to be responsible towards him. And this responsibility obviously carries many things with it, right? The hadith from the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, he says, وَالْمَرْأَةُ رَاعِيَةٌ عَلَىٰ أَهْلِ بَيْتِهَا. So we have a hadith where the Prophet talks about كُلُّكُمْ رَاعٍ وَكُلُّكُمْ مَسْؤُولٌ عَنْ رَاعِيَةٍ. Every one of you is a guardian and responsible for those who he guards. And he classifies and he breaks it down. And he says, when it comes to the wife, she's also a guardian. She's a guardian for her house, for her husband, for her kids. And it's her responsibility that she takes care of her ba'al, her husband. He's under her control. He's under her supervision. He's under her responsibility. وَهِيَ مَسْؤُولَةٌ عَنْهُ. Because she's a guardian, it means that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will question her about her subject. So if she was the queen and the king in the house, we have a king and a queen. The king and the queen, on day of judgment, Allah will say to them, you were responsible of your subjects. What have you done? How have you treated them? They will be questioned for the subjects. So Allah is putting the woman here in the same spot as the one, as the queen who's in charge of her subjects. Allah will say to her, well, the husband was one of your subjects. How did you deal with him? In the same way, Allah will ask the male. There's a responsibility that needs to be fulfilled. But the first point a sister needs to understand that she has a responsibility towards her husband. Let us take a short break and then we will come back.
Ayatollah Javadi Amoli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون. اینم هم امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned.
تو نظام اسلامی این جلد دوم جاش خالی.
We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Mafatih al-Hayat, Keys of Life. We said previously that the first thing a woman needs to do is to understand that she is responsible for her husband, and he is one of her responsibilities. The first thing that she needs to do in this term of responsibilities, and obviously the Ahl al-Bayt salamullah alayhim, they give a long list, but I will just mention a few because time is not on our hands. He says that a woman needs to respect her husband in the house. Now, let me tell you why it is extremely important for a woman to respect her husband. And respect in terms of, for example, at least treating him as a human being first, treating him as a man second, treating him as a father if they have kids, treating him as a husband. So there are things in terms of titles need to be observed. So for example, if I go to the doctor and I don't respect him, I don't call him doctor. I'm not disrespecting him per se, like using foul language, but I don't call him doctor. I call him by his name. Wouldn't you say to me, this is very disrespectful? Like his name is Dr. Ali, and I just go, Ali. I'm like, Ali, come here. Ali, check this out. Ali, check that out. He said, look, this is very disrespectful. The guy has a title. A doctor, you call him a good doctor. An engineer, you call him an engineer. A president, you call him president. His highness, you call him his highness. So there's a respect in terms of even titles. When it comes to the husband, he has three titles. These need to be respected because keeping the hierarchy, meaning keeping the system flowing, when we don't look at each other as, you know, for who we are, the system will break down. And this is something that Hollywood is trying to break down, for example, especially when it comes to kids. They're trying to take down the value and the status of the father. They're trying to take down the status and the value of a mother. They start to take down the status and the value of parents altogether. And they're making the children, have more authority over the parents than the parents have authority over them. And they're breaking the constitution of a family. Same thing with a wife. A wife's job is to maintain these things. Respect is required. Being a loving and caring wife, that's one thing. Having respect to the husband, that's something that he needs to have to understand that he is still in charge of the house. He's in charge of the family. If the father or the husband does not feel respected in his own house, then he will never treat the people correctly. He will always be lacking. He will take it somewhere else. He will go and he will start another relationship where he feels respected. And then we have what they call these days cheating, right? The reason men leave the constitution of the house, or the at least the circle of the house, is what they lack in the house. So the first thing Islam says to the woman is that you need to give him the adequate respect he needs if you want to maintain the safety and the sanctity of the family. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam says, لو أمرت أحدا أن يسجد لأحد. If I had the call to order someone to prostrate to someone else beside Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, ordered the woman to prostrate to her husband in the form of what? Respect, right? So the Prophet saying, respecting the husband is such an important aspect of the constitution of the family. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my son, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. I've dug the earth with my hands, my bare hands. I've searched for my roots in this soil, this holy land, the land which is yours and which is mine, Palestine. And you, good earth, glorious land, son to you, see, I offer my son to you, only to you. I lifted his head from his mother's arms, I put him on your chest, still in red, to water you, you of my roots, Palestine, 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 Palestine. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my child, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since the story of my anger and your blood, the story of our mother's tears and your brother's cry, have to take us on, have to take us on. Lullaby, my darling, lullaby, my dear, sleep in peace, sleep in silence. Since somebody inside my aching heart, somebody inside our land, our blood joins in sacrifice, sacrifice. Your blood roots me here, this land.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says it has carried out several fresh strikes against Israel's military sites, causing casualties. Also coming up, Iran's president says Israel has failed to achieve its goals in the Gaza war, adding that